Hello, beautiful people. My guest today is Mike Maples Jr. And I am so excited for you right now because I just re-listened to this conversation and I got so excited. Mike's optimism, his wisdom combined, it just creates such a magical experience. And I was so grateful to be a part of this. We spoke about blockchain. We spoke about the printing press. We spoke about why it's important to manage your own psychology in chaos. We spoke about Mike's parenting advice and why the courage to be disliked is actually a strength. This conversation, like I explained to Mike, was the mind-blowing emoji over and over and over again. And I am so much better off for having had it, for having recorded it, and I hope you are as well. If you have any thoughts or feedback about this episode, let me know on Twitter at @HeyDannyMiranda. I'm so excited to present to you this conversation with Mike Maples Jr.
Interesting people, thought-provoking conversations, nutrition for your brain. Journey through the minds of the world's top performers and discover what it really takes to achieve your highest version. This is the Danny Miranda Podcast.
Mike Maples, it is such an honor to have you here. I've been going through your work and your ideas, and there are few people who are as clear thinkers and who express themselves in such a way as you do. And I'm so, so excited and honored and thrilled for you to be here. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Well, thanks for having me, Danny. I'll try not to disappoint.
So why don't we start with the bottle of Macallan single malt scotch in 1972. What was that bottle, and why did that bottle play such a significant role in your life, and what lesson did it teach you?
Well, yeah, so it's a co-founder that I worked with deserves most of the credit for this. So one time we had started this company in 97 called Motive. And we had filed our S-1 to go public in Q1 of 2000. And right as we were about to go on a roadshow, the market tanked. And the longest the market had ever been closed is 9 months. 4 years later, we went public. And so it was like one of the most crazy nuclear winter times ever in the history of tech. And so we just had to fight and scrap and scrape our way through. And we were... It was early 2004, about 6 months before we ended up going public, and we had 1 hour left in the quarter, and one of our orders fell through, so we had to find $1 million in 1 hour. And, you know, it's kind of like, what do you do? And so our CEO, Scott Harmon, had the presence of mind to remember that one of our customers, the executive sponsor, really liked Macallan single malt scotch. I think it was 1973 was his favorite year, if I recall. And so he calls this guy and says, and he gets, you know, voicemail. And he says, this is Scott Harmon from Motive. I'll give you a bottle of 73 single malt Macallan scotch if you call me back in the next 10 minutes. And so sure enough, he did. And he was kind of laughed. He was a British guy, laughing in his British accent. He said, guess what? I'm going to make sure that your order gets to the front of purchasing. And it was a $1.5 million order. And it closed 7 minutes before the end of the quarter. And it was kind of an interesting example because, you know, they don't teach you how to do that in business school, right? It's one of those things where you're kind of, you got to channel your inner MacGyver, you know, and call your talent at will to address a situation that seems impossible and that can't be solved with any conventional way.
Was there a moment when you used that example yourself and did something where you recalled something from a long time ago that helped you in a situation?
Yeah, well, I think that where it helps me is when I'm working with all these startups now, we encounter a lot of near-death experiences. In fact, I'm not sure I've ever worked with a startup that didn't encounter several. And there's this saying, you know, it's WIFIO, W-F-I-O. It means we're effed, it's over. and every startup goes through multiple Wifio moments. And, you know, I think it's an underappreciated trait of great founders is that some just fold. Some are just like, this isn't fair. You know, this customer backed out of the order. What am I going to do? Now we're not going to be able to go public. I've spent 7 of the best years of my life doing this. What am I going to say to the board? How am I going to explain this to Wall Street? Blah, blah, blah. And like when you're in that moment, you don't have the luxury to waste any ergs of energy on that. You have to care about one and only one thing, which is how do I solve the problem? And so, you know, in that situation, Scott and I were in a room. We're like, okay, we have 1 hour. We need to find $1 million. So the first thing we need to do is figure out who has $1 million that might give it to us. And then the second thing is we have to get in touch with that person so that they'll know to make the order happen. Nothing else really matters, right? Like all that other stuff is just noise and monkey chatter that prevents you from calling up your talent at will. And so I think that maybe sometimes as a investor, I could be helpful to founders when they face those Wifio moments, because usually there's a way out. But like you have to, it's kind of like when you're learning how to drive a car fast, you don't look at the pins or the obstacles or the wall. You got to visualize the path through the pins. You know, handling these Wifio moments is a lot like that.
Yeah, tell me about the Wifio moment or the Wifio moments that happened with Chegg. I know that was a particularly crazy story from listening to the podcast you did with the founder of Chegg.
Yeah, so we had one after the other there, right? So we were doing classifieds for college, and then we had about 90 days of runway, and we were about to go raise our Series A, and Facebook launches classifieds. And so we're like, okay, we got a problem here, because if Facebook executes on classifieds, we're out of business. If they don't execute on classifieds, we're still out of business, because how are we going to raise money? Nobody's going to think that we can beat Facebook at this. And they're going to think that if Facebook can't execute on it, then we can't, because we're a startup. And so, you know, there's no way we're going to raise money on this idea. And so what do you do? And so we had this textbook rental idea that we'd kind of thought about doing in the future when we had more money. Well, now we were just like, okay, we've only got 90 days left. It's better to burn out than fade away. The fall semester is coming up. Let's just go all in on textbook rentals and see if we can prove enough to convince people to fund it more. And then we ended up putting a little bit more money in because that wasn't going to be enough time to really prove the idea. And then nobody would loan us money to buy these textbooks to rent out. And we didn't have a warehouse, and so we would ship them from Amazon, and the customer would say, well, hey, what's up with this? I thought I'm renting a textbook from Chegg. I got this book from Amazon. And we'd say, oh, it's just a clerical error in the supply chain. You know, please ship it back to Chegg. Here's the address. And in the meantime, nobody would loan us money for the working capital to buy these books. And so Usman ended up having like 20 Amex cards that he charged up like $3 or $4 million. And he had to sleep next to all these cards because at any time Amex might call him and say, hey, look, our fraud department thinks that this is concerning. And if that happens, they shut down his credit cards. He's out of business. And so, and you know, during the day, every employee of the company would have one of these credit cards and they would be round robining, going to Amazon to buy as many textbooks as they could, one at a time, until they max out the credit card. Then they go to the next one. So it was a pretty wild time. And you know, it's like the product was working, customers liked it, but we still could have gone out of business just because we just couldn't keep funding the business, or we would have had bad customer satisfaction because they would have wanted the textbook. We couldn't get it to them because we couldn't buy it. So it was one of those where it was just like every day was just a wild, crazy, you know, we're on the verge of going off a cliff, and then it would just somehow, Ayush and Usman would just MacGyver a miracle. And, the whole team that they had this ethos of just never say die.
Tell me what you are saying to Usman, the founder, and tell me like the conversation that occurs and how you are approaching it when you find out that Facebook is taking over your territory.
Yeah, the main thing I try to do, the thing that some investors do that I don't like that much is they add to the stress. you know, they're like, oh my God, what are you going to do? Like, we're going to lose all our money. Like, our business plan is foobarred. Like, how are you going to solve this, founder? And, you know, the founder in a situation like that, it messes with your head already. And so I think that the best thing that you can do is say, hey, look, I've seen way crazier than this. I've seen way worse than this. There's a path through this, but like, we have to just not waste a single erg of energy on anything other than getting through this. Nothing else matters right now. And so every problem has a solution. And so let's think about how we're going to work our way to the solution. And there's a few techniques I found that are helpful for founders. One is to write your thoughts down by yourself. You just go, you go into a room, you get a clean sheet of paper, and you just, it has a way of forcing you to be clear about what the issue is. You know, so it's sort of like back to the example of the Macallan Scotch. It's like, we need to find $1 million in the next hour. How do we do that? Like, nothing unrelated to helping us do that goes on this sheet of paper. So I have to clarify my thought process on how I'm going to get it. I need $1 million in an hour. So therefore I need to find people who have $1 million who will sign an order in an hour or less. And I need to have them engage with me. And so like, you can write that down in 3 to 5 minutes. So I find that just writing it down, what needs to happen, can be very helpful and focusing, because then you could say, hey, this isn't that complicated. Let's get to work on it. The other thing I encourage founders to do is have friends who are not investors, not me, who have done startups and experienced the WIFIO moments. And the thing that helps with is usually those founders can't help them solve the problem they're in because it's just too nuanced. But it's good to just have somebody that you can have some almost like a therapy session couch time with, where you can say, hey, I'm facing this issue and it feels kind of impossible and I'm terrified and, you know, I'm not quite sure the way out. It's helpful to have somebody who's knows what that feeling is to be like, oh man, tell me about it. Like, I remember, like, check out what we had to face in this situation, what we had to, you know, MacGyver a miracle and cheat death. And so that's the other thing I found. And it's helpful not in terms of solving the problem. It's helpful in terms of managing your psychology. And so all of these issues kind of relate to how do you manage your psychology as a founder when things go really wrong, which they will. And in many cases, the difference between the successful startups and the failed startups are the leader in the successful startup was able to get better when things got tough. You know, they were anti-fragile rather than fragile. And some people are fragile and they studied a bunch of frameworks and management techniques and stuff in prior companies. And, you know, they don't teach you how to do any of this stuff in any management class or any business school class, right? It's like, it's just, you gotta find a way to come up with a miracle on the fly.
So the game is improving one's psychology. And so you have, on one hand, you write it down and write down the problem, write down the potential solutions to that issue as one way to manage the psychology. Another way is talk to a friend as a therapist, as a way to replace a therapist. That's another. What other ways would you suggest to manage one's psychology?
The other way, I think, and it's related to psychology, but it's also related to these WIFIO moments. It's you want to get the team involved in creative problem solving. So it's bad if you as a leader say, hey, look, if we don't solve this problem, we're out of business. That's bad, right? That just scares people and amplifies the panic. But it's better to kind of say, okay, hey, folks, we got this problem. Amex isn't going to allow us to charge more than $1 million on a credit card. But if we can't buy these books, we're out of business because we can't serve customers. So what do we do about that? And you'd be surprised at what people come up with. And this is why it's valuable to write things down at first, because you're able to articulate the problem in a non-fear-based way. You just say, here is the thing that needs solving, and we can't waste any hours of energy worried about anything but solving this thing. And so do we have ideas? And, you know, you'd be surprised, like, if you have a good startup team, people come up with pretty creative answers. And so, you know, you can engage your team in a way that builds a sense of camaraderie and trust around, hey, this is why we do startups, you know, to take on these kind of problems and solve them as a team. And it creates a huge bonding experience when you come out the other side. And then you as a leader build trust with a team because they're like, wow, we even got through that. You know, this person knows what they're doing. I could follow this person to battle right behind them. I could be in the foxhole with them when things get really tough.
You kind of want the problems to slowly get bigger and bigger because then there'll be more trust that's built. Is that correct?
Well, you don't necessarily want these horrible problems, but there is an opportunity. There's a leadership style that you can embrace that improves trust and that over time makes the team stronger if you handle it correctly. Whereas what you don't want to do is be completely on your own, isolated, alone with your thoughts, freaked out, panicked, not exploring the different creative ways through the problem. That's the place you do not want to be.
You've said before that your superpower is category design. Could you expand on what exactly that means?
Yeah, I guess the way I like to think about startups is there's no reason for a startup to exist unless it radically changes the subject. So most people are on the path they're on, and they're conditioned to like things, and they have preferences. So everybody's mind has a bunch of containers in it. And when you're a startup, you have a choice to make. You can either say, I'm a better version of something that's in one of your existing containers. Or you can say, no, I'm a totally new container. You've never seen this before. And the problem with being in an existing container is now you're playing the comparison game by the leader's rules, by the leader's pre-existing rules. The other problem with it is it's not credible. So like if I don't like it if you mess with my head, right? And it's like if I believe that there's a certain answer for a certain issue and it's in one container, now you show up as a startup and say, hey, that thing that you believe, that's not true anymore. I'm a better version of the thing that's in that container. It's not credible because the incumbent has thousands of employees. And they have supply chains, and they have customers, and they have expertise and a track record. Now you show up as a ragtag startup with five or six people. It's not very believable that you're going to be able to have a better solution, or that you're going to be able to do the job, or that it justifies the risk. And so now you're going to have to submit to the rules that the incumbent has defined about how the competition happens. What you instead want to do is say, I'm not the best, I'm the only. So I like to say you want to force a choice and not a comparison. If everybody in the world selling bananas, don't be a 10x better banana, be the world's first apple, and force people to declare those who want apples will want only your apple because you're the only person who has it. And people who want 10 times better banana, you're not going to get their business anyway because the incumbents, they're going to let the incumbent have the first chance to design that offering. So, When you talk to customers then as a startup, different is believable, different sticks and better does not, and different forces a choice, better does not, better forces a comparison. So, you know, it's always about forcing a choice and not a comparison. So then what is category design? Category design is creating that minimum viable, radically different future that the early adopters choose, and then they choose, by choosing that different future, they join your movement, and you move early believers to that different future of your design. And then as the movement accumulates and accelerates, only later does it become a market. The market is an emergent property of the movement, but the movement that you're creating is you're moving early believers to the different future, and that movement defines the category. And so a lot of people think of category design as what's my message, what's my three-letter acronym, but that's not what it really is. What a new category is a different future, and then a movement of early adopters to that different future. And that's why it's category design. It's a future that you don't predict. It's a future that you design, and that you emote people to want to move to.
The example that just kept popping up over and over again is the automobile and the horse and buggy. When the automobile came about, a lot of people probably said, "This is dumb. This is stupid. What is the purpose of this? The horse works. Why are we trying to do the automobile?" And it's fascinating because in order for something new to come about, it almost seems like it has to be crazy to some set of people and also be amazing to a different set of people. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's the place you want to be, right? Like, human beings are conditioned to like things. And so if too many people like your idea, that means it's too conventional, which means it's incremental, which means it could be compared. What you want is a polarizing different future. So you want some people to say, "I don't like that." You want most people to say that, in fact. But then you want some people to say, "Oh my God, where have you been all my life?" You know, like you just brought up cars a minute ago. One of my favorite examples of category design in cars in recent memory is Tesla. And a lot of people don't remember, like, the early Tesla, it's hard to even call that a finished product, right? The first Tesla was like a Lotus body. He slapped some batteries into it. But the Tesla would not have survived a comparison with a normal luxury car, right? Like, if you'd compared a Tesla, which was about $100,000, to any other $100,000 car and said, "What has the better air conditioner? What has the better radio? What has the more integrated system? What has the better lumbar support and seats? What has a better reliability record of repairs and, you know, cost of maintenance and ownership?" Tesla would have failed in all of those comparisons. But what Elon realized was that he was delivering a minimum viable future. People didn't buy the Tesla original Roadster because it was a better car. They bought it for aesthetic reasons. They bought it because they were bought in to his idea of a different future. And so the car represented a movement. It was a symbol of a movement to a different future. And the early enthusiasts who wanted to see that different future come about and who could afford it, they expressed their desire to join his movement by buying that car. And then what does he do in the next generation? He comes up with a sedan that's a little bit closer to mainstream. And then he comes up with a supercharger network. And with every subsequent variation and iteration of that minimum viable future, he attracts increasingly more believers until people start to say, "Wait a second here, this is a valid new category of cars. This is a way." So, like, but did Elon predict the future? No. What he did is he designs the future and then tells the rest of us how to think about it. That's what category designers do, right? And so they realize the future doesn't happen to us, it happens because of us and the choices we make, and they have an intentional idea of what a different future could be, and then they have the persuasive skills to move people to that different future.
Somebody who was definitely a category designer was Satoshi Nakamoto, and I'm curious about the connections you see between blockchain and the printing press.
Yeah, so, like, to me, the printing press basically was a democratizing technology, you know. So, like, if just for a little bit of historical context, you had a world where the Pope was very central in people's thinking about society. And in the early days, that was good. The Pope collaborated with the knights and the kings to create order in the outgrowth of the fall of the Roman Empire, because the Roman Empire had become corrupt and screwed up. And so the Pope tried to establish some order. It was very good. It was good for peace. It was good for prosperity. But what often happens is the ruling institutions go from being service providers to rent seekers, and they start to become more interested in preserving their status and their own institutional power than they become interested in performing the original function and mission of the institution. And so you got to a point where the Pope had multiple illegitimate children. They were exacting tributes from citizens all throughout the lands. They were, you know, basically looking at the citizens as not customers anymore, but like people to fleece, sheep to fleece. So in that backdrop comes three technologies: gunpowder, printing press, and double entry accounting. And the printing press allowed Martin Luther to basically publish the Bible. And now all of a sudden, lots of people could read the Bible, not just a subset of elites who had to go inside of a repository to even have access to the Bible. Double entry accounting allowed the merchants of Venice to trade and transact in a decentralized way because they could keep a record of debits and credits with each other and not have central authorities be involved in any way. And then gunpowder changed the balance of power for violence because now a knight on a horse, if I have a gun, I could shoot him off the horse. And so that changes the symmetry or the asymmetry of power that the knighthood had enjoyed. And so all of those things recast society, right? So when I look at the internet and Bitcoin today, the internet reminds me a lot of the printing press because now anybody can bypass the gatekeepers of the traditional media. And then Bitcoin is kind of a very sophisticated accounting system that allows people to exit the fiat currency system if they don't believe in the way central governments are treating the money supply. And so both of those technologies have a way of decentralizing activity in the same way that back in the day that gunpowder and the printing press and the double entry accounting did.
Take me through your first finding of Bitcoin and what that looked like and how you evaluated this as something to invest your money in or to believe in or not. What is your thought process? What was your thought process when looking at Bitcoin for the first time?
Yeah, so there's a book that I read that really influenced me a long, long time ago. It's written in, I think, like 1970, called Exit, Voice, and Loyalty. And like, let's say we're in a country, some people are like super patriotic, like kind of no matter what America does, they're like, I'm an American, American flags, love it or leave it. So those people would be loyalty. Voice is kind of how I talk about San Francisco. Like, I love the city and think it could be the coolest city in the world, but there's a bunch of real problems and we're in a state of denial and things need to change for it to achieve its promise. So that's voice. Exit is when you just say, you know what, enough is enough, I'm out of here. Like, I'm not going to try to fix this, I'm leaving. As a customer of this society, I'm taking my money business and my tax-paying business elsewhere. Exit is what gives voice its power. Because if I'm forced to keep customers, I'm forced to treat them as people I serve rather than people I fleece. And so what Bitcoin did was it basically said, up until now, I've had no choice. If I think that the Fed is mistreating the dollar, my only choice is to own a different kind of currency that's being mistreated. But if I believe that fiat currency is becoming increasingly illegitimate, which I tend to believe, then what am I going to do about it? I have no way to exit. Bitcoin provided me a way to exit. It allowed me to say, you know, as a customer of money, I'm going to take some of my money business elsewhere. And like, if you guys who are the stewards of the dollar don't get your act together, I'm just going to opt out. I'm just going to opt out of the dollar system as a currency. And if a whole bunch of other people do that, then you're going to have a problem. And so this is why, but it's bigger than just Bitcoin. I think it's about networked societies writ large. And so, for example, COVID allows people now, you know, in the past, if you didn't like San Francisco, politicians say, tough luck. If you want to be in Silicon Valley, this is the place you want to be. If you want to be in tech, this is the place you got to be. And so it allowed them to treat citizens like they were cows to be milked or sheep to be fleeced. But now the cows can grow wings and fly away, right? And so COVID allowed people to say, wait a second here, I could go to Miami. I could do whatever I want to do in Miami. I'm a customer of government, just like I'm a customer of money. I can exit. And so that the beauty of our system in the U.S. is we have 50 states and we can A-B test these ideas. And so now, because of cloud and cloud culture, people can exit physical locations but still live in the cloud and be part of a networked economy where the network pays you for giving it what it wants, but it doesn't have as much of a hold on you in terms of physically where you have to be. And so now the government has to treat you like a customer and not an asset, or you won't be their customer for long.
Balaji has this great idea, which is that the mayors of different cities are going to start becoming entrepreneurs or look at themselves similar to CEOs, because that is what they're doing. They're creating a new company that is their city. And nobody better has done it than Mayor Francis Suarez. Excuse me, from my perspective, Mayor Francis Suarez is doing an incredible job. So what makes for a good mayor in the 2021 environment?
Yeah, so I think that there's a couple of things that are happening right now. So my basic view of a lot of this is that we had a system that framed our society that created extraordinary abundance. It started in the early to mid 1800s, and it was this idea of mass production and mass distribution that created big business, big government, big states, big military, big media. And in the early days, it was very good. It created extraordinary abundance, right? So like from the year 1850 to the year 2000, GDP on real terms per capita went up 14x. I mean, it's a freaking miracle, right? The richest guy in the United States in the 1870s when he died was Cornelius Vanderbilt. He's worth like 3% of the U.S. GDP. And he didn't have flushing toilets. He didn't have running water. He didn't have electricity. He didn't have a car. He didn't have the stuff that poor people have today. And so most people would like to have Cornelius Vanderbilt's money. But even if you asked a lot of poor people, would you want to have to go back to the 1870s to have it? They'd say no. Because, you know, you get some random disease, they can't fix it. You're done. And so the amount of abundance that was created was extraordinary. And what created it was mass production allowed us to produce things at ever lower marginal costs. Mass distribution, powered by the railroads, allowed us to get these things out to the people. And then electricity came later, and so that we could power our society and have modern conveniences. And so, like, in the sweep of history, it was a miracle. What happened, though, is what often happens in institutions. A lot of these institutions went from being wealth creators and service providers to, unfortunately, becoming what I call rent seekers. They became more interested in preserving their own institutional power, and the people within these institutions became increasingly more focused on preserving their elite status. And so, like, what happens in a lot of situations like that, it goes from being very productive, very effective, to now all of a sudden it becomes permission-based. You have to start to ask for permission to do anything from these privileged elites. I think that basically that got supplanted by what I call mass computation and mass connectivity. And this started to develop in the late 60s. With the birth of the microprocessor and some of the early foundational thoughts around the internet from DARPA. But what mass computation and mass connectivity do is they animate a different kind of economy. You know, the industrial economy, to me, the big symbol of that was the River Rouge plant at Ford, which was this massive plant where metal comes in one side and a Model T comes out the other, and you employ tens of thousands of people. It's just gigantic. We're going from the River Rouge plant to personal 3D printing. And so what computation and connectivity have a tendency to do is, rather than centralizing the means of production around scale, they tend to decentralize the means of production around networks and the edge. And so what we're seeing happening today, I believe, is that we're starting to realize that the institutions that predated the internet and the microprocessor aren't working anymore. And we've kind of known it, but it's kind of been the secret in plain sight. So people talk about fake news, but I see in the Fortune 500 fake growth. You know, you have the Fortune 500 spending $800 billion a year to buy back their own stock. So you had institution after institution that predated microprocessors and the internet unfortunately, they've progressively become more rent-seeking. They've progressively become more interested in preserving their institution than they have in performing the mission of their institution. So, you know, does anybody doubt, like I tried to get a passport a few months ago. I did this rush your passport thing. I'm supposed to get it in 3 days. 6 weeks later, I didn't have it, and I almost couldn't travel. Does anybody doubt that if Amazon was subcontracted passports, that they would have better know your customer, that they'd have less fraud, that they'd get it done in 2 days at a tenth of the cost? There would be literally a 1,000x improvement if you did that. And so to me, that's kind of what we're seeing writ large with like the CDC. You look at the institutions that responded well to COVID, they were all invented post the internet. And by the way, that includes like Moderna and the folks who were, you know, engineering some of these vaccines. Most of them came from technologies and people and approaches, organizations that were invented post the internet, post the microprocessor. And the ones that were, and you know, Afghanistan, we see it yet again. The institutions that we trusted to execute that were formed in the old industrial era of centralization and big whatever it is, they tended to not perform. You know, they tended to not just not perform, but radically underperform in an extraordinarily disappointing way that kind of caused people to say, hey, wait a second here, what's going on?
What can the United States citizen do if they recognize this, that the government is not up to the standards that it once had because of the network effects or because the complacency? What can the United States citizen do to promote a better United States in 10 years or 20 years?
Yeah, so the first thing is, I don't mean to come across as like bashing the government or military or media or whatever, right? Like what I'm suggesting is there is a natural cycle in life, right? And it's also true in companies. Like my dad, when he was at Microsoft, I'd ask him, what's better, a centralized org or a decentralized org? And he said, yes. And I'm like, well, what do you mean by that? And he said, well, You get into a situation where when you have a centralized org, you can make decisions really fast. You can move very fast. But eventually what happens is it becomes a caricature of itself and it stops moving fast. And the people in the center want to make all the decisions. And now before you know it, nobody can get anything done at the edge without asking for permission. And so things slow down. That's when you want to be decentralized. Decentralized, now everybody can make things independently happen at the edge. But he's like, you know, you do that for too long, and then you find out you have five different charting widgets in the office team. You have three different ways to do copy and paste. You have like a bunch of duplicative efforts of teams that aren't talking to each other. So you say, hey, wait a second. Why don't we have one charting widget that works in all of our office apps? Why don't we have one way to exchange data that works in all of our office apps? Then you go back to centralization. And so that's been the arc of history, right? The Renaissance and the Reformation decentralized things because Martin Luther and a bunch of other people started to say to the Pope, you're illegitimate. And people started to not need permission to publish books or read books or to transact business. Well, then the industrial economy came and re-centralized things. And then that kind of started, the pendulum went too far to centralization. And you probably had the peak of it in the late 50s where you had two superpowers, three TV networks, you know, two parties of government. But that was just kind of how you assume the world works. And the, you know, giant organizations where you were the cog in the wheel. And now I think the pendulum needs to swing back to more decentralized approaches. And so back to your question then, what I would say to people growing up now in today's world is, it's not an issue about who's good or who's bad. It's just that the arc of history is moving in the direction of decentralized institutions that are powered by mass computation and mass connectivity and network effects. And so those are the institutions you want to be part of rather than the ones that are trying to preserve themselves against an inevitable tide that's going against them.
What's the best way for us to, let's say, in 10 years or 20 years or 30 years or 50, when can we notice that decentralization is getting to be too much and we need to swing back to centralization. What are the key things we should look for when it's getting too decentralized?
Well, we're a long way from that. I don't think that's going to happen in our lifetime, right? Wow. So, you know, the Industrial Revolution, we assume that business how it is, as it's been is how it's always been. And we assume the federal government is kind of how it's been. We don't realize it's only a 150-year artifact of time. And that business and government and institutions haven't necessarily been what they're like now. So, like, here's an example to think about. Like, back to exit voice and loyalty. Back when the Pope was the central arbiter of all things, and when getting excommunicated by the Pope meant you're basically SOL, the Pope was a big deal, and everybody knew it, and everybody acknowledged it. There are still people today who are super Catholic and like think the Pope is like amazingly important. But, you know, and I'm not trying to get into a religious thing here, but like I imagine that people like yourself and myself would probably say to those people, great, you know, that's great that you think the Pope is awesome. But like, I'm not that preoccupied by it, right? There's other stuff I'm more worried about than what does the Pope think. Nothing against the Pope. That's just how I am. I think that that's how we're going to start to see a lot of these centralized institutions. Like right now, I think people invest way too much of their energy and emotional identity into what political party they're in or what tribe they're in that's like thousands of miles away. It doesn't really affect their day-to-day life very much. Now, the power of these institutions is going to wane, but it's going to be just like what happened with the Roman Empire when it started to wane, or the Pope. You don't really need to say anything about it, right? It's just some people just recognize the new reality and act upon those realities and prosper in those new realities. But you don't have to say the federal government's not going to matter. It's just I believe it's going to matter less, but it's not me casting aspersions on the federal government. I just think that in the world ahead, the role they play is less important. And, you know, some people are going to be religious about thinking it is, but it's just going to be that's the story they're telling themselves. It's not going to be reflective of the facts on the ground or what's happening or how the people who are moving in the direction of the future are making decisions.
How does it look when or if, I don't know if it's either, but you tell me, how does it look when or if the dollar collapses?
Well, I hope it doesn't. What I believe is that the ability for people to exit the dollar gives the federal government an incentive to manage the dollar far more responsibly than they have so far. So right now, if people really paid attention to what we're doing to the dollar and the way we've been playing with interest rates and the money supply, people would be, there'd be mobs in the street, right? I mean, it's one of the, I think that the way we've treated the dollar has created, has contributed far more to wealth inequality than many people realize. Because like, if you're going to just print money, the people who get rich are often the people who are closest to the money printer, not the people who are working hard. So for example, the Fed jacks with the money supply, prints a bunch of money. Now I'm a hedge fund. I loan money to IBM at 0% interest so they can buy back their own stock. And then I go long on IBM because I know the share price is going to go up. Well, in all of that transaction, did we create any new jobs? No. Did we make any better new products? Did we create any new breakthroughs? All we did was accelerate the financialization of the economy. And the people who profit from that are the people that are closest to the money printer, not the people who created the most economic output in a real sense. And so, you know, you look at when we went off the gold standard in the early 1970s, and you track wages and you track all the indices of wealth equality versus inequality, and the gap is expanded extraordinarily rapidly between the haves and the have-nots. And a lot of that, I believe, is because of the financialization of the economy and the incentives that it creates for people to play these financial shell games rather than to focus on creating economic output that advances the standard of living for people.
The people getting rich are the ones closest to the money when it is printed. That is such a crazy concept, and I'm so grateful for you for bringing that up. It's just a different way of thinking about the world. but it does. It's so similar to me of what I think of when I think of Soviet Russia and the way the world operated. Is that correct? Or tell me from the historian that you are.
The Soviets are a different thing, right? The Soviets were a more coercive prospect. But the part about this that is so, in my view, immoral is, let's suppose that I'm close to the money printer. And I just know the right people so that I'm close to the money printer. And then there's some poor person who works for an honest living and they're far away from the money printer. Well, I grab a dollar from that money printer and I buy products and services from that person at the edge who's not near the money printer. That person doesn't yet know that the dollar is worth less than they think it is, right? And so inflation is a form of theft where the people close to the money printer are stealing from the people who aren't close to the money printer because they are, you know, it's kind of like monopoly money that they're using to buy stuff that's real from people producing real goods and services. And so in the end, inflation born of the Fed jacking with the money supply or low interest rates born of the Fed jacking with the money supply is a wealth transfer from the producers to the people who are close to the money printer. And, you know, nobody ever really frames it that way, but it's the reality of the facts on the ground. It's just like with the Obama stimulus. Who got rich first? It was the people in D.C. because they were close to the money printer, the shovel-ready projects. And so, like, if you want a real estate tip right now, it's probably buy property outside of D.C. because the people right in the outskirts of D.C. are going to benefit from a lot of this stimulus money and, you know, all the money printing and all this other financial shenanigans. And, you know, their land isn't, they're not making a lot more of it. So it would not surprise me if the property in the outskirts of Washington, D.C. goes up a lot, just like it did after the Obama stimulus. And you know, it's kind of the natural consequence of, you know, rewarding unproductive behavior of people who are close to the money printer rather than rewarding productive behavior that contributes to the standard of living and productivity in our GDP.
What would you recommend a normal American citizen do about this if they're hearing about this for the first time?
Yeah, I think that normal American citizens, the path in the 20th century would be to join a scalable institution, like a scalable company, a scalable government agency, you know, military, whatever the case may be. What I believe is happening is that the force that animates the economy going forward are scalable startups. And so startups used to be just something that was almost like a hobby turned into a business for me. But I never thought of startups as at the center of the economy. I thought of it as just something I enjoyed and was passionate about and wanted to help startup founders. But now if you look at it, if you look at what's happening with the stock market, if you look at the valuable companies, almost all of them were formed post the internet, except for maybe Apple and Microsoft, who like embraced the internet in a very big way and you know, could be thought of as digital native companies for sure. They certainly were around after the microprocessor. So you say, okay, what do we think is going to happen in the future? I think scalable startups are going to animate breakthroughs that create a different future. So the 20th century, you got rich by investing in companies that were a bet against a different future. You were betting that Coca-Cola was going to be the leading cola producer 50 years from now. Geico Insurance would still be a leading insurance company 50 years from now. GE would be there. IBM, the Washington Post, you know, all these companies. But to me, the big idea of today is that the companies that are animating the economy are the companies that are creating a different future, that are creating new categories rather than dominating existing categories for decades. And so if I was a young person today, what I would do is either try to start one of these new movements that creates a different future, or I would try to learn what represents a valid movement that creates a different future and try to join one of those movements as a co-conspirator, right? And so, like, to me, these movements that change the future are like positive conspiracy theories. And it's a conspiracy to create a better future. And so you're looking for co-conspirators. And as a co-conspirator, you could play different roles. You could be the prime mover, like Elon Musk, or you could be somebody that joins the movement and tries to drive things forward. And what I'm hoping that happens in our society is, I think we need the greatest generation of the 21st century. You know, we need, my grandfather was in World War II and the Depression, and they changed the future by the way they behaved. We could have had a different history had they not stepped up when the times demanded it. My goal and my duty, I believe, is to help people understand what's happening, what a breakthrough looks like, why it's an important duty for all of us to join these movements that will create breakthroughs that create a different future. Because we're at an inflection as a society. We can either build breakthroughs and say it's time to build, or we can tear things down. And you know, that's happened in the past, right? The Roman Empire went through dark ages. If we make bad choices as a society, the inflection could go downward, and we can end up being worse off. So the future is not going to happen to us. It's going to happen because of us. And so, you know, people who are tearing things down are literally tearing things down. They're tearing down statues. They're renaming schools. They're saying we don't need to have objective standards for who gets in or how we measure people's performance. All of these things are, you know, the approach of people who don't have a determined view of what a good future should look like. And so they tear things down. Whereas what I want people to understand is that there is a path to a different and radically better future, and that the way that you can be part of that movement is to join one of these breakthrough movements and be, you know, part of creating that different future that we all decide to design.
Okay, so you're a young person. You know you should be joining a breakthrough movement or a breakthrough company. How do you go about identifying these are the companies that fit the breakthrough company model?
Yeah, I'd say that the main thing is it's a company that can't really be compared. And so, you know, Tesla still is good at avoiding the comparison game because they envision a different future than most of the car companies have. And so Tesla is not just a car company, and it's not just a category king in electric cars, but it's also a movement towards sustainable energy. SpaceX, same thing. So I'd say that the first thing I would look for in a movement is it an institution that was created that post-dates the creation of the internet? Is it designed at its core to be a software-defined, network-centric business? Because the iPhone is that for phones, Tesla is that for cars, Lyft was that compared to taxis, right, for ride-sharing. The taxis tried to be rent-seekers with the medallion system and lobbying governments. The only way that taxis are going to survive in a fundamental way is by regulatory capture and lobbying the governments, right? They can't compete on a level playing field because they're designed on a set of assumptions that predate microprocessors and the internet. So I'd say that'd be the first thing is, when did the institution start? What is its point of view about what creates abundance? Is it economies of scale, or is it network effects? And then I'd say that the other thing that I would look for is, do the people leading the institution understand software in a fundamental way? And so I would assert to you that any institution in today's world that the majority of their leaders don't understand software in a meaningful way is a failed institution waiting to happen. You know, because software and networks are the Archimedes lever that animates the creation of abundance and competitive advantage going forward. And if you don't understand how those levers work, you just fundamentally can't compete in the world that's ahead. You're going to have to ask for handouts and crony capitalist laws, regulations. But like, you're, as an institution, you just will not be able to compete with an institution where the executives are digital natives that understand these things, right? Because they have an Archimedes set of levers that you just don't have that can move the world where you can't.
What do you mean by Archimedes set of levers?
Yeah, so Archimedes had this saying that I love that said, give me a place to stand and I can move the world. And so, you know, this idea that you have a lever that's powerful enough that you can use that lever to move the world to a different place. And so, like, to me, software and networks are the Archimedes levers of the 21st century. And software provides this multiplier effect that the world has never seen before. And it allows value creation to happen in the world of bits and not just in the world of atoms, which is good in the sense that it creates a more potentially sustainable future where we don't exact as big of a toll on the environment for inputs and outputs in the products that we make. But I like to say, you know, people in the 20th century talked about labor and capital, labor versus capital. To me, in the 21st century, atoms are the new labor and bits are the new capital. And the bits tell the atoms what to do. The bits coordinate the activities of the atoms. And so, you know, if you want to be where it's happening, you need to understand microprocessors, algorithms, network effects, because those are the things, those are the forces that are going to command the contracts and the economic transactions and that just the, you know, the invisible hand of the future of how trade happens.
Along those same lines, you've said before that robots going to eat the world or eat the jobs rather is a wrong concept. And a lot of people have heard robots are going to eat the world or eat the jobs. So why is that a wrong concept from your point of view?
Yeah. So robots eating the jobs is a great example of this saying, you know, generals tend to fight the last war. And so when people say robots are going to eat the jobs, they reveal a certain worldview that they have, which is that the world is centered on these traditional industrial giant institutions, factories, big businesses, where everybody's a worker, they're a cog in the machine, organization man, play by the rules, you get promoted, you get a gold watch when you retire someday. And like, we need to do something about this social contract that's dissolving. You know, that's their worldview. But what they don't understand is that the world they're living in isn't that world anymore. They just don't know it yet. They've allowed their ego and identity to get too attached to that prior world. And so what I believe is happening is actually software is eliminating the need for people to need to work at companies. And it's like in the past, you had to work at a company because you couldn't get distribution. You couldn't produce your product at scale. You didn't have all the raw materials to produce something. So you had to make a trade. You had to say, I'm going to be part of this organization, part of this org chart. And we together as an organization are going to build things, distribute things at scale. Well, now people can exit that system and they can say, hey, wait a second here. I can use software to find my customers. I can use software to distribute my product. I can use software to build my product. I can use software to collaborate with anybody anywhere in the world. And I can think of myself as not living in a one giant organization for my whole career. I can be in a whole lot of networks at the same time. And I get paid when I give the network what it wants. And so I think at the limit in the 21st century, what we have is a worldwide network of individuals, all of whom have comparative advantages, and all of whom get paid by the network for giving it what it wants. And as a result, we don't think of ourselves as affiliated with any one given company. We think of ourselves as affiliated with this giant global network that we can add value to. And we appropriate value as a function of giving the network what it wants. And so, you know, kind of at the limit, it's kind of the startup of you. And so what I think we need to train people to do in this century, unlike last century in K-12, we trained people to be employees to follow the rules. What we need to help people understand in the 21st century is it's going to go back to the startup of you and having agency for your life and having, you know, this ability to sort of shape your destiny and define your own future. And that's actually a good thing. And that, you know, the old social contracts had a lot of downside to them as well, because people had to subordinate their own desires and their own ideas and creativity to the needs of the team and the needs of the big organization.
So if you're creating a school right now for a kid that's entering kindergarten or entering homeschooling, what is the program that you have them follow over the next, let's call it 10 years? It's the school of you, and you want to teach them these importance of personal agency and understanding that the world is working in a decentralized way and they should focus on their strengths. Talk to me about the plan that you would create for that individual, that young student who is going to matriculate to a high school and college, but making their own.
So I would say that just like a lot of institutions, I think unfortunately our K-12 system and arguably our university system are old institutions that are rent seeking, more focused on preserving their power and their positional authority within these institutions than they are, unfortunately, in delivering good service to their constituents. And so, you know, in K-12 education now, you can hardly measure anything because people don't want to be held accountable for any kind of standards. People are taught to the lowest common denominator because you got everybody in a classroom. There's a natural rejection of new technology that could disrupt the current union industrial complex that runs these K-12 institutions. I think the only way you make progress is to exit them. And so I think that what we need is different types of network-centric schools that do a couple things. One is make better use of application software to let people learn according to their own pace. And then related to that would be objective criteria for people showing that they learned what they've set out to learn. You know, more objective test scores, more objective credentialing, more objective, you know, they learned this or they didn't learn this, tracking of things. And then I think that the other thing that we need in our schools is life skills, financial literacy, thinking about probabilities and understanding, how to think about the odds and not just deterministic ways. But there's a whole lot of things that we're not teaching people in school that would have a really big impact on their success in life. Computer literacy, I believe, should be taught to everybody because it's the animating force of our economy. And so if you don't understand to speak computer, it's like not knowing how to read as a farmer in 1900, right? You're just not going to benefit from the coming prosperity. So I believe, and the other thing is, if you think about schools as network-centric by design, yes, you have your local affiliation with your school, but like let's say you've got a whole bunch of people who are interested in creative writing. Why can't you have a network of people who are interested in that? Why can't you have networks of gifted and talented students? Why can't you have networks of people who are interested in math or, you know, different kinds of life skills? Why not affiliate yourself with these networked societies or these networked academic institutions in addition to just the physical one that you're a student of? And so I think that there will be an unbundling of education over time, and it will fragment into these networks that people can opt into or out of. And, you know, you'll be able to exit the network if the network isn't giving you what you want, and you'll be rewarded by the network if you give the network what it wants.
Would it be possible for a startup to come in and start creating education in this type of way and be a startup? And I think that there's a real need for that in the world.
Yeah, I think that's what'll happen. And this is what makes me optimistic for the U.S. is the fact that we have 50 states benefits us a lot, because if San Francisco is going to decide to be woke and politically correct and rename schools and teach CRT and have masks all the time and never have kids come back to school, now parents are going to have a choice to opt out of that system. Then you got Mayor Suarez who says, hey, wait a second here. We want to do things that are future oriented. We want to build tunnels under our city. We want to blast rockets into outer space. You know, in California, if you want to blast rockets in outer space, good luck. Somebody 1,000 miles away could complain that the ground might rumble, and you'd have to have their permission, right? They could, you know, California has become a vetoocracy, unfortunately. And so, okay, now Mayor Suarez could say, how can I help? And you know, people who want the default assumption to be, let's try it, they can go to Miami, or they can go to parts of Texas, right, where the government has their back. And now we get to run that experiment. If we want to build new cities that only have self-driving cars, if we want to have tunnels under the ground, if we want to blast rockets into outer space, if we want to mine asteroids and all that stuff, the people who allow that to happen and aren't vetoocracies, we'll see who wins. We'll let them not be permission-based about it. We'll let people do the San Francisco way, and we'll just see where the smart people want to go. Let the best system decide the answer. And so the fact that we have 50 states is a very powerful rejuvenating factor, because different states can say, I want high taxes or low taxes. Different states could say, I want big government or small government. Different states could say, I want to be a vetoocracy versus a meritocracy. Different states can be woke versus, hey, you know, individual agency is what we want to value. And you know, people listening to this may disagree with my choice on a lot of those dimensions. That's fine. Go live with the people who agree with you. But, like, don't make me choose your choice if I disagree. And so the 50-state system that we have is a very powerful way to allow people to exit according to their beliefs to a new place that embraces their beliefs. So that makes me optimistic that we can reinvent our institutions by exiting the broken ones and by reconstituting them around kind of the new technologies that will create abundance for us all.
You know,
it'd be harder if we had a homogenous state where all the laws are the same. You know, I feel for the countries where that's true, because that's harder.
Yeah, there's certain power in the diversity of the United States, and the fact that it is diverse is to our benefit. You know, I wanted to talk to you about the education and bring children up. And I love your advice for parenting in general, which is two things. One, to train your kids to be optimists. And two, your kids didn't ask you to be born. I think this is such powerful advice. How did you come across that? Like, how did that advice come to you? And could you expand on those two pieces and anything else? I'd love to hear that.
Yeah, so I guess I deserve, the person who deserves kudos for this is this guy named Alfred Adler. So he was a psychiatrist at the turn of the century at the same time as Freud. And so he and Freud and this other guy named Jung used to hang out in cafes and, you know, have salons and kind of debate things. And you know, Freud is the guy that kind of became the most famous, but Adler's the guy that I've always liked the best. And Adler had three philosophies that I think are very empowering, especially in today's world. The first thing that he said was that your past doesn't have to define you. So this is why where he broke away from Freud. Like, Freud had a tendency to say the child is the father of the grown-up, and that things, trauma that happened in your past define who you are today, and that, you know, they cause you to encounter hurdles, and, you know, the operating system of your mind gets screwed up based on what happened in your past. And Adler said that's not true, that the past doesn't exist anymore, that the there's only one thing true of the past, and that's the story you choose to tell yourself about the past. So if you choose to tell yourself, my parents were bad to me, so therefore I can't succeed, you will act less courageously than if you say, hey, whatever happened, happened. What do I do now? So Adler's view was that life is a series of moments, and that you can choose at any given moment to act with courage or to tell yourself a story about your past that caused you not to act with courage, and that you'd use that story as an excuse, right? So that was the first thing that I really took away from him. The second thing was, it's unwise to compare yourself to other people. And so when you compare yourself to other people, you become overly concerned about how other people think about you. And you become overly concerned about approval-seeking, status-seeking, mimetic behavior, imitating other people. And, you know, people want to have status and be compared, even if it's bad. You know, in classes you have the class clown. Why would you ever choose to be a class clown? Because now you have a position. Like, now you're known for something in a community. Adler would say that's bad, that's a bad thing. And then the third thing that he said that I really respected was this separation of tasks. And this gets to parenting. So everybody in life has a set of jobs that are their jobs to do, their tasks. And then but the problem in a lot of relationships is people perform the other person's task. So what do I mean by that? Let's say that I want my kids to get good grades. I would like to see that happen. But if I go to them and say, hey, look, I know what's best for you. You have to get good grades. You have to do this many hours of homework a day. And just because I'm your parent, I said so, deal with it. Adler would argue that I am not respecting the separation of tasks. He would argue that there's a couple of flaws in my behavior. And some parents who are kind of like alpha parents, tiger moms, you know, may disagree with me here. But I would say the problem with that behavior is, as a parent, I'm letting too much of my own identity be tied up in how successful my kid is in school. I'm trying to get status based on having my kids perform well, which is bad because I'm seeking status and comparing myself to others. And it's not their task to give me status. It's their task to act with courage in whatever moments they face in life. So my job as a parent should be to encourage them, which literally means give them more courage. But the way you give somebody more courage is not to say, do this my way, I'm in charge. The way you give them more courage is to say, look, if you're looking for my help and how to think about this, the way I think you could exercise the most courage in this moment might be to consider this. But it's up to you to decide, right? It's not my task to do it. It's your task. And so, like, what are some other separation of task kind of things? You know, you probably experienced this in life. Some people don't like you for unfair reasons. You know, I'll get people on Twitter saying stuff about me that just isn't true. Well, I can let that bother me, but that would be a mistake in my view, because it's not my task to convince them. And if they decide that they're going to believe something false about me, it's not my task to convince them. And, you know, in the end, if they're going to believe true things, it's their task to care about the truth and to seek the truth. But it's not my job to help them with their problem when it comes to that. And so this separation task. So then you say, okay, you have kids. Did they choose to have me? No, I chose to have them. So they don't owe me anything. And so now if they're grateful to how I raised them or get along well, and fortunately they do, it gives me gratitude. It gives me peace of mind. It feels good, but they didn't owe it to me, right? It's something that was a good byproduct of us having a good relationship. So that's kind of how I look at it. And so why do you want them to be optimistic about the future? I mean, we're all going to die, at least so far. But the paradox of that is the fact that we get to live at all is a miracle. And so every day is a gift. And so we should be grateful for the time that we have. And the best way we can live our lives, I believe, is to honor the gift of our time by acting courageously and offering our gift to the world in every moment that we have going forward. And then when we pass on, we can say, I honored the gift, which is kind of the best way I could have actualized my life. And so to think that way requires you to be optimistic by definition, because the fact that you get to live at all should make you an optimist. And so that's kind of it's a long-winded answer to your question, but that's kind of the frameworks that I use to kind of reason my way through that stuff.
One of the gifts that you have is you are so likable. In every conversation that I encountered with you previously in podcasts and all this stuff, I have people who go to the closing words, they won't let you go, and they keep the conversation going with you after they've tried to say goodbye because they're enjoying it so much. So what advice would you have for someone to become more likable?
That's a good question. My advice would be not to worry about that too much. And so I wish that I was sometimes more disagreeable. Like, I concluded through time that I couldn't be a CEO of one of these breakthrough startups, that I could never be an Elon Musk or Jeff Bezos because I didn't have as much of the courage to be disliked as they did. I cared too much about having friends and people like me. And by the way, I'm not saying that to pat myself on the back. Wanting to be liked is a form of manipulation. It's a form of manipulating the other person to act towards you in a certain way. And so, like, I don't say that, hey, I've got a bunch of friends and people like me as a gesture of self-respect at all. It's a weakness I need to work on that limits my ability to pursue certain missions in life. And so I concluded I needed to be a VC because I needed to find those people who had the courage to be disliked on the path to creating breakthroughs that change the world. And, you know, breakthroughs by definition require you to have the courage to be disliked, because what do you care more about? Making the breakthrough happen against the, you know, the president's going to fight back, and people who like the way it is are going to say bad stuff about you. And so they're going to dislike what you're doing. And so what's going to matter more to you, succeeding in the fulfillment of that breakthrough or coming back to those people, getting them to like you? That's forcing a choice and not a comparison, right? And so it's kind of interesting when I think of Adler writ large, it's really about being your own category of person, being the only you that is, because rather than compare yourself to others, instead make a choice to be courageous in that moment in honoring the gift of your time. And so that's going to require you to be disliked by some people, because some people want you to fit within their schema of things. And if you're going to be the only version of you, by definition, you can't. By definition, you're going to force people to reconcile you rather than be reconciled by them. And so, I actually would not advise people to be too likable. I'd say that likability is a personality trait. What I would advise people to do is figure out their gift and figure out their mission in life to honor that gift. And the highest integrity lifestyle they could live would be such a life. And probably the most rewarding life as well.
What's the best way for a young kid to figure out their gift?
The way I've done it in recent times is I'll look at my calendar, and I know this is different for when you're young. So first of all, I'd go to Patrick Collison's website and read his page of advice. It's freaking awesome.
Amazing.
Right? We'll link it below. In terms of specific things to do, I'd do that. In terms of what I've learned in recent times is I do a personal energy audit. So I'll look at my calendar, and I circle all the things that were on my calendar that made me excited and happy. Where when I woke up in the morning, I was like, I can't wait for that. That's going to be fun. I'm going to like that. And I've learned over time that I didn't even circle them based on how valuable it was. How much money did I make doing it? How effective was it for the company? Blah, blah, blah. What I learned is that understanding what drives your energy contains more info in it than just what it is. It gives you a sense of what does it feel like to honor the gift of your time, and to kind of understand why did it drive my energy and what was it about that made me excited, that made it feel like a good use of time. And so that's the other thing I've learned, is to lean into the things where when you see it on the calendar, you're psyched, and to be the best version of yourself at doing those things, and to be a little bit more courageous about saying no to the other stuff. And to realize that there's other people in the world that get excited about that other stuff, and that's what they should be doing, not what you should be doing. And I, you know, some people say, well, that sounds kind of indulgent and all that. But I've learned in some ways it's not, because if you're being your best self, you become irreplaceable, because there's only one you and you're being the best version of you. And so now you're being not the best, you're being the only. And you're kind of operating at the intersection of what you care about, what you're good at.
Oh my God. You speaking just as the mind-blowing emoji for me over and over and over again. Thank you, Mike. Before I let you go, I have to get your thoughts on NFTs. What do you think of this crazy new world that is the NFTs, and where is and are NFTs going in the next 10 years from your perspective?
Yeah, to me, NFTs are sort of part of this larger move towards networked culture. And so I just believe that we're gonna live in a world where most of the value that happens in the economy is gonna be in the world of bits, and you're gonna have digital assets, and even assets that are physical are gonna have cryptographic keys that define who owns them, who doesn't, because bits are the new capital and atoms are the new labor. And so just like it used to be you could trade your dollars for gold, most people wouldn't do that because it's easier to transact business in dollars. I think what's going to happen in the future economy is we're going to transact most business in the world of bits and touch atoms as a last resort, just like you touch gold as a last resort when you trade dollars for gold. And so, in fact, you may never need to, right? And so that's where I think we're headed. And I think NFTs are an important part of that because they allow digital assets to be scarce and not just copy it a billion times and make it free. Sometimes you want scarcity because it encourages behaviors where people allocate their comparative advantage and collaborate better. And so in producing economic output. So I think NFTs are going to be one of many things that enable an economy in the world of bits to be the primary medium in which economic behavior happens. But I don't know if NFTs will be up or down in the next year. I mean, I like to say all of it will happen. The question is just when. Hopefully I'll make a few bets that are ahead of it. But, we'll see.
I have no doubt those bets will pay off. Thank you, Mike, for taking the time. Where can people find more from you?
Yeah, probably best podcast Starting Greatness or Twitter at M2JR, probably the best two places.
Awesome.
And good luck, folks out there. Go get it. It's never been a better time to be alive than right now. So, be grateful that you're in one of these times in history that's going to be a transition that creates potentially abundance for every person on the planet. And, let's make the choices to inflect things in the right direction because it is a choice, right? So, choose wisely.
I love it. Thank you, Mike, for taking the time. I really appreciate it.
All right. Thanks, Danny. Good to see you.
What a beautiful conversation. Thank you for listening until this point. I hope you got something from this episode that you can take with you that can help you in your life in some way. Mike Maples is an absolute treasure, and I'm so grateful for him. Thank you for listening until this point in the episode. It means the absolute world to me. I'm extremely grateful for you. And if you have any thoughts, let me know on Twitter at @HeyDannyMiranda. That's all for me. I'm excited to hear your feedback. And until then, I will see you in the next episode. Peace.